Tonight I wanted to use as a starting place for this talk this verse in the section of our new sutra book called Gatas for Daily Life. Gatas are verses designed to aid in practice, to be kind of focal points, reminders of practice. And these are from Robert Aitken's book called The Dragon Who Never Sleeps, which is a fabulous book. Number six, for those of you reading along at home. When I panic at losing my bearings, I vow with all beings to acknowledge the error is panic, not losing familiar ground. So, So I want to say a lot about this. So by way of introduction, I also want to say that panicking at losing your bearings is one way that this can definitely apply. Another way it could apply is if you have firmly and decisively gotten very clear bearings on where you are, and where you are is totally and irremediably screwed. both of those happened to me. So these verses all use in Aitken's form. They all use these four lines, and the second line is "I vow with all beings," and this is a really beautiful part of the practice. This. It's a acknowledgement of our inner togetherness with all beings, of the reality that we're all in it together, and that our practice is not just for us, it's not just about us, it's not just, or sometimes even at all, ours, but it is all beings together practicing. One of our other liturgical pieces reminds us that it is actually Buddha's practice, Buddha actualizing Buddha, not our practice. And so, but at the same time, the only place we meet it is in our lives. And so we are responsible for taking up this practice of togetherness, of meeting this non-separation. And so we vow. And this vow is the same as our bodhisattva vows. This is the same as our refuge vows, to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. This is the same vow of atonement, the vow to take up the paths of the precepts. And with all of these vows, it's not about getting into some vow-fulfilling state and staying there forever. Or if it is, I don't know anything about that. And hallelujah that it's not, because that's not where we are. That's not how we can engage it. And so it isn't a matter of you've got your vow on or off. You know, it's not a binary thing. This vow is is giving voice to our practice. It's a restatement of our aspiration. It's realigning us with how we mean to be. Our vow to save all beings, to serve all beings, our vow to cease from harm, our vow to do good, to actualize good for others. All of these are our vows. This is how we engage our practice. This is how we engage our practice in our off-the-cushion life, which is most of our life. And we so much want to make ourselves separate and special. And And we so badly want to be separate and special that we actually don't care which way it goes, whether we're particularly awesome or particularly bad. As long as we're particularly special, we're happy. And for most of us, then that defaults into being completely sure that we're completely separate and alone in our awfulness. And so here we're vowing with all beings. And this vow that is not a state, this vow is not that is not something we get and hold and keep. It's just reorienting. Again, finding our bearings from the pole star, for instance. Seeing where we are, lifting back up our gaze to who we mean to be, to how we mean to be in the world, to how this moment in fact is and how we can meet it. Lifting our gaze up to that. In full knowledge that in the next day, hour, week, moment will fall short. And then atone is the next thing we do. To be at one with the acknowledgement of our having fallen short. And again, return to our vow. And to do this with all beings together. All beings meet our successes together. All beings fail with us and need to return to their vow with us. And so this is a practice of these vowing with all beings is a crucial element of our practice. And it's a crucial way to connect in togetherness and humility with all beings. And it helps us gain perspective that we're not in it alone. And so there's comfort there in doing this with all beings. And we see this same comfort and support in our Sangha here when we, together with all beings, sit at 7 o'clock on a Tuesday night. And that all beings together enable us to sit and in a way that is much more difficult if it's just us on our own. So, and there's something real and energetically powerful about physically being in the same room as each other, which is why we do this. And we can, to a certain extent, tap into that power by practicing together with all beings, by vowing with all beings, by failing with all beings. So, when I panic at losing my bearings, so this has been my practice this week, especially. In addition to the powerful and provocative decade anniversary of what happened on 9/11 and the ramifications of that, that we've all been kind of pounded with by the media everywhere we turn. And so there's a way that that is provocative and disorienting. And then for me, tomorrow is actually the 5-year anniversary of my father's suicide. And I always find this particular period in September particularly disorienting. And part of it is, and lots of fear comes up for me. Lots of panic comes up for me. Part of it is that is fear that I have the capacity in me, just as my father did, to make a huge mess of my life He made so many bad judgments, bad decisions upon bad decisions. And he, prior to that series of bad judgments, was an enormously successful and good person. And after, he was still a good person. And it's particularly disorienting, our karma with regard to our parents, the space that our parents occupy in our mind, the power of that archetype is almost kind of unmatched in our psyche's culture. And so part of what I wrestle with is that I'll be found out, that it in fact will become public knowledge that I don't have the requisite skills to be a functional adult, and that I've really actually been fooling everybody for all of this time. That's part of my fear. A, to be found out, and then B, just the reality that I actually don't have these skills, as is clearly demonstrated by my inability to cope with any aspect of my life whatsoever. And one of my my day job is a job that, for the most part, I love very much. I edit Dharma books for a small publishing house, medium-sized publishing house, who does just Dharma books. And I'm always also worried that a series of bad decisions on my part, putting books under contract that shouldn't be under contract, or publishing books that are just, I should have put out of their misery long ago, you know, that a series of those and the whole company will go under and it'll be my fault and everyone will know it. So the message of this Dharma talk is buy Dharma books. If you get nothing else from this talk. And it is absolutely assured. And on Monday, in the midst of my week of there's a word in the field of psychology, which was what we when I used to be a behavior therapist on a locked ward with people with brain injuries and behavioral problems. It was a word I encountered there, but it's actually all over the field of psychology. It's a word to describe the state of affairs that goes on in a patient, for instance, when they are perhaps renewing their behavior of throwing chairs at people, throwing punches at people, swearing, and just being totally out of control, which is the people that I was working with, or having full-blown psychotic episodes. And the word to describe what's going on there is called decompensating, which I always have found kind of humorous, it's kind of nice in a way, because it kind of acknowledges the reality that we're all just fundamentally crazy to begin with, but most of the time we can compensate for it. Except then when we decompensate, then the crazy comes full to the fore. So during this week, that is always kind of a week of decompensation for me. At work, there was all kinds of stuff going wrong. Very little of it my fault, but most of it falling either to or at least very near me to fix. And so that triggered a lot of panic in me. And then that panic also triggered my
panic around the fundamental reality that I'm going to be unable to manage my life, myself, triggered more panic, and I did what I needed to do for the most part on that day at work, got everything taken care of to the extent that I could at that time, and then I said to my colleagues, "So I'm going to take the rest of the afternoon off to go home and freak out a little." Put the covers up over my head, took a bath, and just generally kind of was with that panic. And this panic, this kind of thing, is not unusual for me. I have all my life kind of on some kind of greater or lesser period wrestled with depression in some form or other, in a cyclical fashion. And then in the last 5 years, I've had this particularly intense thing around September's. And the beauty, the gift of this kind of cyclical, repetitive, you don't get to fix it once and for all and be done with it kind of stuff because it comes again and again and again, is that you get some practice with it. It can become familiar. Oh, right. This is this thing where I am totally freaked out. Right. And that doesn't actually stop the freaking out. And it doesn't actually fix the whatever it is. But this familiarity, being able to recognize that there's just all of these mental formations and physical sensations and emotional contents that are the turnings of fear and, oh my God, it's so not okay. To be able to meet those maybe spaciously in some moments, and sometimes the best that I can do is just kind of batten down and just in a really kind of focused way, I don't know, kind of be overwhelmed work with that feeling of overwhelmedness, not by trying to hold back this overwhelming tidal wave of stuff, but by really paying attention to desisting from all of that effort and just letting it pummel me, surround me. And when that happens, there's this other kind of okayness that starts to creep in that is not related to not being overwhelmed, to not being a crazy person, to not being battered by fears and doubts. To be in that groundless space of not knowing, to be away from the familiar ground of confidence in my constructions of who I am and what the world is. When all of those things, when that familiar ground gets lost, there's a Zen practice to vow with all beings to acknowledge that the error is panicking in response to that, not to the reality of losing that familiar ground, not to the reality of those or the other side, or of taking your bearing and finding yourself screwed. That's not the problem. That's actually not the problem. There's no error you made that led to that circumstance. That's the nature of being, which includes the reality of suffering. That's the first noble truth of Buddhism. And losing familiar ground, being in this place that either where what we were clinging to as certain is gone, or where we don't know what else to do. This is part of the practice of meeting the mystery of life. The error we make is panic. Now, error is an interesting word. We can also say problem, but problem is also not it either, because the panic is fine too. So what I might suggest we hear is that the place to practice, the thing to pay attention to our inner relationship to, is the panic, not the losing of familiar ground, or not the gaining of the familiar ground of screwedness. And we practice this. We literally practice this in our meditation, in our zazen. This thing is exactly the thing that we're practicing. This skill of working with the panic of losing familiar ground. This is when we reach the point in our practice where we are starting to deconstruct some of the rules, the objects, the instructions for how to practice zazen by, for instance, attending to your breath, by, for instance, attending to your sensations or counting the breath, or bringing your attention to your posture. When we start to deconstruct those, or bringing your mind to the koan, mu, when we start to take away those structures as we move into the practice of the practice of not a technique, just sitting. Shikantaza, it's called in Japanese. We are losing familiar ground. This is why Shikantaza is not a technique. If it were a technique, you could get it and master it and have it and make it really familiar. And then it would be of no use to you when you lost familiar ground. Then it's just another game to play. So it's stepping off this cliff of the known, stepping off the cliff of the familiar, stepping off the cliff of the doable and knowable, and meeting the reality of our free fall. This is the thing that is a useful skill. It's in fact the useful skill when life is at its most painful, frightening, overwhelming, unfixable. And this is why we practice, and why we do it with all beings. And this reminder to come back to doing it with all beings. And here, with all beings and for all beings are not different. All beings are doing it. All we have to do is join. And even that is more than is needed. There's great support from the community of all beings, all of us who are approximately 6 or 7 miles outside of our comfort zone at any given moment. So I wanted to read this is Ezra Beda from a book called Saying Yes to Life, Even the Hard Parts, that I worked on with him, and this is a very helpful book, and it was profoundly shaping for me. And so although Ezra is kind of a cousin, maybe, in one of our lineages, a distant kind of cousin, I view him as one of my close teachers. Transformation. The basic pain of feeling separate and disconnected is a fundamental human experience. Yet when we consciously resign in the physical feeling of separation, we come closer to recognizing its insubstantiality. Continually bringing the light of awareness to our viscerally held beliefs, our pretenses, our protections, our anxieties, begins to dissolve these self-imposed boundaries, the boundaries that block awareness of the vast reality of being. This is the slow, transformative path to freedom. The slow, transformative path. It is transformative. It does lead to freedom. Footnote, and this freedom isn't what you think or wish it were. And it is slow. But even in its slow, it is very real. The basic pain of feeling separate and disconnected is a fundamental human experience. Yet when we consciously reside in the physical feeling of separation, we come closer to recognizing its insubstantiality. And so here, in the example of feeling separate, this is like what I was saying of desisting from fighting that tidal wave, but really receiving it and noticing it and seeing what it is. When we do that, we come closer to recognizing its insubstantiality, which doesn't mean it's not there and real. Continually bringing the light of awareness to our viscerally held beliefs, our pretenses, our protections, our anxieties, our mental formations, our certainties, our stories, begins to dissolve these self-imposed boundaries, the boundaries that block awareness of the vast reality of being. This is the slow, transformative path to freedom. So, once more from Aitken. When I panic at losing my bearings, I vow with all beings to acknowledge the error is panic, not losing familiar ground. So, I want to open up the space for responses or comments or forms of panic.
Right. I feel like, oh, yeah. unpleasant, but it's going away. I can just be sick now. I don't have to worry about being sick anymore. I'm just going to be sick.
Yeah. And so what you're pointing to there is in a way, it's the power of the five remembrances, which and so when we find ourselves getting sick, ah, yes, this is getting sick. I'm of the nature to get sick. When we find ourselves growing old and losing our faculties, ah, yes, this is that. When we find ourselves actively engaged in the imminent process of dying, ah, yes, this is my nature. And when we're beset by loss, right, yes, this is that loss that I've heard about. And change. Yeah. And this is also related. One of the things that, I think I may have mentioned this before, one of the things that has become enormously useful to me, but was totally useless at the time when somebody first said it to me. This is when I lived at Zen Mountain Monastery, and when I was caught up in just the big angsty mess of my life. And the person who was a head monk at the time, she said to me, "Josh, it's just your life." And I was like, "Yeah, it's my life. That's the problem. It's my life." But in time, that's come to be very liberating. And Harriet's pointing to the liberation that we can feel when we identify, ah, right, this is food poisoning. This is sick. Thank you. Sitting in Zazen, I vow with all beings to remember, this is it. Darkness and light are not the separate things we're so sure they are. Which doesn't mean that the darkness isn't dark.
To have a frame of reference.
perfectly natural to lose that term of reference from time to time. You kind of holding that together with the aspiration to sort of, from the flip side, kind of always be using familiar ground. It's not an error to be using familiar ground. I mean, a kind of definition in the statement, almost the continuity. And just holding those two realities together is a call to me in this kind of thing.
Did you want to comment? Yeah, and so. This is a reminder that the endeavor of Zen, so this what you call the okayness of the familiar, the endeavor of Zen is not to just be baffled and unfamiliar with everything that happens to you. There's a role for beginner's mind, and there's a role for look both ways before you cross the street and stop at a red light and go at a green one, and not the other way around. That's okay too. Frames of reference are okay. But the thing we need to remember is that the okayness that comes from being within our frame of reference is conditional, circumstantial, fickle. And by definition, it'll fail at the worst times possible. And so this is why we need to find this other okayness too. Did you have something?
Some of you know I'm a teacher, so losing my bearings is kind of part of the job, especially around this time of the year. I'm having a great summer break where I redefine my familiar ground to the first day of school, where I redefine my familiar ground as second new students. And, you know, as the year goes on, we're kind of always either figuring out what familiar ground is or changing that ground. And I kind of resonated with what you were saying earlier, this question, what, like, is there familiar ground or is this just an illusion? One of the things that I was thinking about most recently was as the first day of school approached, it was last Thursday, I was sitting and thinking about my very first day teaching, my very first day, 4 years ago. And how incredibly out of my books I was. Nervous, I felt like an 8-year-old the night before Christmas. And I was so tied up with worrying about how everything was going to go, how I was going to present myself to the students, how I could be myself in front of them, how I could show them how wonderful our class would be for this year of learning what we're going to do. And looking back on that and realizing where I was now, where I am now, where I was 4 days ago, having a clearer idea of what to expect, understanding that there is chaos for, you know, these first couple of days and being okay with that, understanding that. For a while, the ground would be kind of unsure and pushing as we, time goes on for a month. And it may become unsolved again.
Excellent. Yeah.
I actually have my own comment, if I may. a kind of very literal experience of that gatha. Because I was spent that past week sea kayaking, and on the way home, this is a solo trip, and on the way home or on the way back to my car, the last mile, there was a hurricane coming offshore, and the sea was kind of whipping up a bit, and there was wind, and it was very gray, and I was tired, and I still had like a mile to go across this very difficult coast to get to the car and where familiar ground lay. And this was the worst mile of the whole trip. It was big ocean swell coming in and just smashing itself against rocks, and these enormous booms coming up. Honestly, I thought it was dynamite when I heard it, and then it would be, no, there's not dynamite here. That's the waves hitting the rocks. And I found that as I was paddling through this, and, you know, the boat's going like this, and the waves are, like, coming, and I had to get through it. And so panic arose, and in this very unfamiliar ground, and I found myself tensing up, and you know, the windmill starts, right? The paddle's gone, and just get me out of here, which is not helpful at all. At some point I realized that I was doing that, and there was this sort of quiet place in the midst of all that was going on around me that said, oh, this is panic. This is what I do when I panic. I do this. And it's never helpful. And maybe if I can just, I mean, here I am upright. The crashing's going on over there. I can see where I need to get to. It's just a half mile more. Maybe if I just paddle slowly and carefully, might work out better. And that was what got me back to the familiar ground. I don't know what the lesson in all that is. I just wanted to share it.
Come on.
So, I definitely would affirm that there are a lot of problems that come from trying to put all of our energy into becoming a great iron wall to keep something, including some part of ourselves, away. And the alternative image is to sit like the great ocean and receive everything with equality. Receive everything just as it is and let it all in. That isn't the same as acting impulsively. And so there's a way that sometimes we may get paralyzed with the stories that we're telling ourselves or decisions we have to make, and we need to do something with the best degree of effort we can, with the best of our limited ability, the best of our limited information, the best of our limited capacity. Our karma as it is, we have to take some action. And so there are often a place where doing something is key. But this spiritual practice is not a practice of becoming impulsive. And in a way, it is almost the opposite. So it's a practice of being able to see vividly that impulsive urge arise, and then having a moment of choice. Okay, so is there wisdom and utility in acting on that impulse, or would that not be so skillful here? That's what this path is for. And sometimes we act impulsively, and we work with that too. But there's actually a traditional centuries old misunderstanding that arises in Zen, that that Zen is about just doing whatever occurs to you, or Zen is about responding to the suffering of the world by putting your sandals on your head and walking away. You know, that it's somehow that it's somehow just about, I don't know, being weird. And it's actually much more than that. And at their best, those kinds of acting outside of the box are coming from a moment of clarity in which we're seeing how the stories we're telling ourselves, the rules, the arbitrary rules we're applying to the situation aren't necessary, aren't useful, don't serve wisdom, don't serve kindness, and that there's another way to respond. All of these things that we were talking about, vowing to cease from harm, to do good, to actualize good for others, vowing to be at one with this moment as it is, vowing with all beings to acknowledge the error of panic, all of these things are things that in a way countervail that impulsive urge. So the impulsive urges still arise, but through this practice of zazen, through this practice of noticing when our mind moves, returning it back to the breath, back to the posture, back to one, through that practice we are cultivating a capacity to be able to meet each moment with choicefulness and not just autopilot impulsivity. Which is not to say that, and there's creativity, which is maybe a positive form, but it's not a word I would. So creative is definitely in the ballpark related somehow to impulsive, but it's its own thing, and that there is lots of positivity to be found in meeting a moment with creativity and creativeness.
This might be too little, but when we're talking about all beings, who is that exactly? Is that everyone who's practicing, or everyone in history who's ever practiced, or animals who don't know that they're practicing? Who is that?
Yeah. And
dust motes are beings, and mental formations are beings, and universes are beings. Excellent. Is there one more? Yeah.
I guess I was thinking when you're in that panic mode, at least for me, I think that I have the intellectual ability to solve a problem, and it just sort of feeds the panic. And if I get to a space where it's quieter, a different perspective arrives on its own, that usually sounds pretty good. It looks good. It looks, and again, that's, it could be the past, but something different arises that I don't feel like I could come at or come to from an intellectual perspective that makes a lot of sense. And I guess I was thinking when you were talking about, when you said impulsive, perhaps people talk about intuition, and maybe that's more intuitive than intuition.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a good point and a good word to bring up. So sometimes we can respond from a place that we don't fully understand, and sometimes responding from this place that we don't understand is very useful and skillful. And it's important to not make a fetish out of being incoherently intuitive. It's, and for those of you who work on koans and doksan, this is part of what we are practicing with koans, is responding from this place that we may not necessarily understand, and seeing that as and not using our not understanding as a way to push away things that are in fact there, and are in fact there for us. So, yeah, good point.
I would even say, just maybe this will clarify, I see impulsivity as reacting. Something happens and we impulsively react to it, whereas a creative action is one that is not referring to anything. It's coming from somewhere new rather than referring back to something that happened before. So it's free to be what it will be. Yeah. So I picture it.
Excellent stuff, everybody. Thank you all so much. Let's make several vows here together with all beings.